So the desperate fight to save our climate continues. My name is Paul Rowland. This has been Wednesday Talk Radio. Stay tuned.
Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the PDX Leo Party, Friday, July 31st, starting at 8 p.m. at Kelly's Olympian. A birthday celebration for all you Portland Leos with special performances from Sleep of Old Dominion and the Chicharrones, Mike Crenshaw, Smoke M2D6, and many more. Again, that's the PDX Leo Party on Friday, July 31st, starting at 8 p.m. at Kelly's Olympian, located at 426 Southwest Washington Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Matt Dishman Community Center annual block party on Saturday, August 8th from noon to 4 p.m. This family-friendly event will include barbecue grub, live music and a DJ, activities for kids, family swim in the pool, local vendors, and more. Again, that's the Matt Dishman Community Center annual block party on Saturday, August 8th from noon to 4 p.m. at Matt Dishman Community Center, 77 Northeast Knott Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. Here's what's coming up this morning on KBOO. First, on Political Perspectives, we hear interviews with David Ray Griffin, author of the new book Unprecedented, and Darja Mail, climate writer at Truthout, about global warming and the need for action now. At 10 o'clock, it's your Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre, and at 10:15 on Flashpoints, we'll hear more on Portland protests on land and sea to block Shell Oil's ice-breaking ship from heading out to the Arctic. Also, we remember the life and times of radical environmentalist and Earth Firster, Judy Berry. And at 11, Kristen Yount hosts a program about the Willamette River Revival. It's a celebration of the future health of the Willamette River with guests Barbara Quinn of the Portland Harbor Community Advisory Board, Feduma Ali of Groundworks, and Roger Wendlick, award-winning Lewis and Clark historian and author of Shotgun on My Chest. All that coming up on KBOO, but first I want to thank you personally from KBOO, from the Air Room. Thank you for your generous support, all you KBOO members out there. If you're not a KBOO member, you can become one easily by going to kbu.fm and clicking where it says donate today. And thank you in advance for doing that. We're going to go right now to Political Perspectives with David Ray Griffin and Darja Mail.
Welcome back to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Peter Phillips with Project Censored affiliate professor as co-host Julie Anjoveski. Today our theme is the global environmental crisis. We will interview Emeritus Professor of Religion and Philosophy, David Ray Griffin, regarding his new book, Unprecedented, Can Civilization Survive the CO2 Crisis? Additionally, we'll talk with Truthout investigative reporter Darja Mail regarding his newest article, Mass Extinction, It's the End of the World as We Know It. We hope you stay tuned.
The people together can overthrow the system. The people together can overthrow the system.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. My co-host today is Julie Anjoveski. She's a professor emeritus of human relations and multicultural education at St. Cloud University, where she co-founded the Social Responsibility Master's Program. She has a long record of teaching and publishing activism for social and environmental justice. Her recent publications include as being co-editor of Social Justice, Peace, and Environmental Education, and various book chapters, one in the censored 2014 yearbook called The Sixth Manth Extinction, which she co-authored with John Alessio. She received the 2013 Michael Harrington Award for Scholar Activism and is a national judge with Project Censored. Julie, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be with
great
you.
Great to have you. Our guest today is David Ray Griffin. He is a professor of philosophy, religion, and theology, emeritus from Claremont School of Theology and Claremont Graduate University in Claremont. He remains co-director of the Center for Process Studies. He has published 34 books, primarily on theology and philosophy, and philosophy of religion, with special emphasis on problems of evil and the relationships between science and religion. Seven of his books deal with 9/11, the new Pearl Harbor, disturbing questions about the Bush administration 9/11, and 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions, also one about Christian faith and the truth about 9/11. David, welcome.
Good to talk to you, Peter.
David, your new book, Unprecedented, is entitled Can Civilizations Survive the CO2 Crisis? In it, you say that 97% to 99.8% of all climate scientists believe that global climate change is caused because of CO2, and that's causing massive warming. How severe is this, and are we really faced with human extinction?
I'm afraid so. You know, when people hear the title of my book, the subtitle, Can Civilization Survive Global Warming? They say, well, that's a downer. But in these circles, actually, it's very optimistic to be able to ask the question, because there are many people who think it's all over, that there is no question about it. I just dealt recently with an Esquire essay that was titled, When the End of Human Civilization is Your Day Job. The author was dealing with climate scientists who have to think about this all day long, and all week long, and all year long, and how do they cope with the realization of what could happen, and how do they deal with depression and so on. So, yeah, it's a very, very serious problem.
So you discuss three possible plans for humans. Plan A is to continue as usual. Plan B is a rational, moral choice for full mobilization of global resources to address the problem. And Plan C is to delay doing much and see how bad it gets. Why is Plan B your choice?
Plan A, which is normally known as continue business as usual, which means at least retaining the same amount of fossil fuel garbage going into the environment or increasing it, which is what fossil fuel companies want. But many people think, well, no, yeah, we shouldn't rush into anything radical to try to change that because, you know, we can just kind of wait and see what will happen. And then if things start going bad, then we can do something.
Yeah.
And the problem is almost everything has already started going bad, just extreme weather in the United States and Canada and all around the world. And some of this is getting so bad. And, of course, in California here, we're in the midst of the fourth year of a drought and very rapidly running out of water. Some cities have already. And the predictions are that we are in for a mega drought in the whole American Southwest, which could last for decades or forever. And just the drought alone will be disasters. Just to take the food issue, which is one of the biggest problems, that California is responsible for 50 to 90% of America's fresh food, and actually for much of the world. And if California can no longer grow very much, then everybody is going to be hurting. And then there are other things that also almost all the elements of climate change will reduce the world's food that will be available. And so the only moral and rational approach is to say, okay, maybe it's all lost. Maybe we don't know. But we don't know for sure. So there may be a chance that we can at least salvage civilization to some extent. And to do that, we're going to have to go into full-scale mobilization, as some people put it, World War II type mobilization, except that we'll have to continue that for about 2 decades if we're going to survive.
You write that extreme weather literally will become hell on earth, that extreme storms, fires, drought. And I was reading just today that you live in Santa Barbara and they were reactivating their desalinization plant, which can be pretty expensive water. So this crisis seems imminent right now, not 100 years from now. Is that correct?
That's right. For a long time, people thought, oh, well, we've got to do something for the climate to protect the world for our grandchildren. Well, now it's people saying for our children, and now suddenly they're realizing, oh, it's also for ourselves. Santa Barbara happens to be one of those fortunate, wealthy cities that can afford a desal plant. But most of the world cannot do that. And so the water situation is going to be extremely serious, not only in the Southwest United States, but in many parts of the world. So in South America, the glaciers and the snowpack is disappearing very quickly from the Andes for various countries. And some are out of water. Others will soon be out of water. There are several famous mountains there. One that's one of the most famous ski mountains in the world is now completely dry. And even worse than that is Asia, where you've got the Himalayas and the Tibet Plateau. And there, the mountains, the snow and the ice are keeping actually billions of people in water. And it is quickly disappearing. And so this is going to be the biggest disaster on the planet when those billions of people no longer have water.
Can you comment on the extreme weather in winters? As we've seen, a lot of people want to say that winter weather means that there is no global warming because you can see all these blizzards and the Northeast getting all this snow. But can you comment on that?
We've had the most ridiculous event in that regard with Senator Inhofe bringing a snowball into the Senate and putting it up and showing, see, there's no global warming. This is cold. What a lot of people don't understand, and part of the language of global warming, if people haven't studied what that means, they think it's supposed to be getting warmer everywhere all the time. Well, no, global warming is referring to the global average temperature. You measure every place around the world and then put all those together and say what is happening. And there's no doubt about that it goes up every year. In fact, it has gone up every year of this decade already. And the confusion there is caused by people don't realize that global warming causes climate change, and climate change takes all sorts of forms. And one form it takes is extremely cold weather in certain parts of the world. And the United States, eastern part of the United States, is one of the parts of that world. And the problem is that the air and the ocean currents have changed. And so, therefore, air that used to be normally tucked away in the Arctic is now brought down into the United States, even as far as Florida. So you have certain weeks where Florida is colder than Alaska. So you can have a heat wave in Alaska, and people, of course, joke about baked Alaska. And that's going on all around the world, where all sorts of patterns are changing. What people were able to be used to expecting can no longer expect. And one of those things is extremely cold weather in places where it should not be cold.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm Peter Phillips. My co-host today is Julie Andrzejewski from St. Cloud University. And we're speaking with Dr. David Ray Griffin about his new book, Unprecedented: Can Civilization Survive the CO2 Crisis? David, what is the risk now of the continuing sea level rise, and how bad could that become?
Dr. James Hansen, who's generally considered the world's leading climate scientist, has come out with a report, he and 16 colleagues, talking precisely about this. Earlier, the IPCC and others were saying that, well, yeah, we're going to have some sea level rise, but probably not so much in this century, maybe a foot. And then other people started saying, well, you know, it could get bad. It could get up to 3 feet. Well, when I wrote my book, I quoted some real experts who said, you know, we've got to be ready for 7 feet, which you can imagine what that will do to not only Florida, but also New York City. Well, now the new report says that we're heading towards 20 feet. And just almost coincidentally, very recently, there was a historical report that 3 times in our long, long history on the planet, the climate, when it has raised above 1.5 degrees Celsius beyond 19th century levels, and anywhere from that up to 3 degrees, all 3 times you had an increase in the sea level of 20 feet around the world. And so the scientists and the pundits have been saying, well, as long as we can keep the global warming down to 2 degrees Celsius, you know, 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit, we'll be safe. So that was called the guardrail. And that's what Paris, the big conference in Paris, is aimed towards, to see if we can keep the average down to 2 degrees. And Hansen had said for a long time that that's way too high. He had a major paper a couple years ago in which he argued that the target of 2 degrees is a prescription for disaster. Well, now his new paper bears that out, and that paper I just referred to shows that 2.2-degree increase will be disaster just in terms of sea level rise, but also in terms of all the other dimensions, that is food, water, climate, refugees. You're going to have, first of all, hundreds of millions and then soon billions of people having to move from where they live to either another part of their country or, like with Bangladesh, to another country.
Are there people that are already doing that?
Oh, yeah, there are many, many people. I don't have the figures now, but there are many thousands of people who've already been forced to move. Some island nations have already made plans to completely leave their island.
Are we in danger, then, of global ecosystem collapse?
Well, yeah, one of my chapters is on that, ecosystem collapse and extinction, which I understand your next guest is going to talk about. And by the way, Darj Mail is probably the world's expert precisely on that issue. So yes, there are all sorts of boundaries, planetary boundaries, they call them, that could lead to ecosystem collapse. The 9 major boundaries they've identified, we've already exceeded some of them, and we're well on our way to exceeding all of them. So yes, Elizabeth Colbert says in her big book on that topic, there's no reason why we would think we human species would be exempt. For one thing, we couldn't possibly be, because as we make all the plants and animals extinct, that's going to not leave much food.
David Ray Griffin, you're the author of Unprecedented, Can Civilization Survive the CO2 Crisis? And in that, you talk about massive water shortages, food shortages, and then the inevitable, what you call climate refugees. Talk about that a little bit.
Yes, as I was saying, several countries have already sent, or people have volunteered to leave, to go to New Zealand or Australia or anywhere where they'll be taken in. India is building a barrier between India and Bangladesh to prevent Bangladeshis from moving into India. Thousands of refugees. That can cause a crisis. Look what happened in relation to the war in Syria, what has happened to the nations around it. But when you get up into hundreds of thousands of people, and then pretty soon millions of people trying to find somewhere else to live because either the place is submerged, so that even if it's not yet submerged, the ocean water has seeped in enough that the ground is too salty for them to grow anything anymore, so they shift over to some other form, and then that no longer survives, and so they finally decide, well, we have to move. We've got to take our kids somewhere where they'll have a chance. So they move into a big city, and we know what happens then. The people in the ghettos in the cities with no prospects whatsoever.
You also link that to the potential climate wars or wars of national security and trying to keep millions of people from being refugees. And even the Pentagon has talked about national security issues around climate change.
Yeah, I've got a whole chapter on the climate wars. You know, it's a big question of the various problems with global warming. I named a 10 in my book, and people move around from one to another. So right now, people in California would think, well, yeah, drought is the most serious issue. But then pretty soon, when the drought gets so bad that we can no longer grow food, then food becomes the crucial issue. But then as food becomes a more difficult thing to obtain, war is almost inevitable. So Joe Rome, who's my book is based to a great extent on his research, his personal. He then shifted over after many years saying that drought was the one that was going to kill the most people. He then had an essay in which he said, well, you know, maybe it's war, because if this gets to the point where we start large cross-border wars, which are mainly to keep the natural resources, the water, the land, and particularly the land that will grow food, that may be the most disastrous one. So, you know, there have been some climate wars already. The press doesn't do much about reporting that. But the Syrian war was to a great extent based on climate failure there.
So how significant is methane to climate disruption?
Well, that's the biggie, because the people who are most pessimistic and believe that the game is already lost in terms of saving not only human civilization, but maybe human life altogether, they point to methane and say that will be the final culprit. So why did my book have in the cottage and the title simply The CO2 Crisis? Because that's where it starts. But then, as the carbon dioxide warms up the planet, and particularly the Arctic, well, then you get this permafrost with an enormous amount of methane stored in it, and it's now starting to come free. And as that continues to increase, then that will change the climate rather dramatically, because methane is many times more powerful as a global warming agent than carbon dioxide. So yeah, that's the really big one. And the times in the previous massive extinctions when 90% of life on the planet was lost, it appears to be now, according to the researchers, that methane was central to all of them.
David Ray Griffin, we know that it's close to, you say 150, I've seen 200 species are going extinct every day. 98%+ of climate scientists are crying severe concerns. Why is there such widespread global warming denial? Where's that coming from? And it's in the media and a lot of political foot dragging. What's this all about?
Yeah, well, I do have a whole chapter on climate denial, and it begins with the fossil fuel companies. ExxonMobil in particular has engaged in really, really hundreds of millions of dollars of work to try to keep the situation the way it is, that is, where there will be no serious regulation about fossil fuels. So they use a lot of that money to bribe congressmen. So when you go on and learn which people in the Senate and the Congress are very supportive of the fossil fuel industry and very negative about climate change, you can see that almost all of them, probably all of them, are receiving enormous amounts of money from the fossil fuel industry. But they also use that money, much of the money, to support organizations around the world which just specialize in climate denial. So you have 80-some organizations that are financed in totally by the fossil fuel industries to promote skepticism. So, for example, you go online and you see some new report talking about how dire the situation is because of this new development. Well, you'll find a few articles supporting that, but then you'll find twice as many articles of people ridiculing it and saying, oh, they're, you know, the climate alarmists are going at it again, and we already know that global warming is caused by the sun or something else, not by human activity, not fossil fuels, and so on. So this is an enormous enterprise. And then the Koch brothers have come along, and they're spending far more now than even ExxonMobil. And then there are two donor organizations, who is known as dark money. And one article in the Washington Post said, well, it's quite likely this is just more Koch money. So that beyond the millions of dollars they've contributed up front to climate denial, there are these enormous amounts of money that maybe they've been giving to these donor institutions.
So, given this extremely dire situation, what can we do?
The last chapter in my book is on mobilization. So, as I say, almost all of the scientists now and reasonable pundits say we need a World War II type, you know, Marshall Plan type mobilization where we would go full out, both in the United States and Canada, but also all parts of the world. And, you know, if we would lead the way, a great number of the other countries would join with us. In fact, many of them are just waiting for us. They say, well, we're not going to do anything unless the United States goes because, you know, they're the major problem. And then some will say, well, no, actually, China and India are the major problem. Well, no, you have to figure contributions per capita. And China and India have such enormous populations that even though China is now contributing more fossil fuel emissions to the atmosphere and the ocean than the United States. Still per capita, there's no contest whatsoever. We're just way above them. And then also, if you look historically, we and Europe have contributed the most to the buildup of carbon in the atmosphere and the ocean. And China has contributed a very tiny bit, India even a tinier bit. But the so-called skeptics, who are really the denialists, they'll say, well, we shouldn't do anything until China and India go first because they're a bigger problem. Well, no, they're not. We're the biggest problem. And we've been the biggest problem for a long time. We're still the biggest problem. And so it should start with mobilization. So that was what I do in my chapter. I focus on how mobilization could proceed in the United States.
David, are you optimistic in any sense in that, like, Pope Francis just held a two-day conference at the Vatican for 60 mayors from around the world that signed a petition to push the UN to really get serious about global climate change? In fact, Jerry Brown denounced global warming deniers as bamboozling the public and politicians with false information.
The Pope has been the biggest ray of hope we have had now. If the Catholics of the world, for the most part, John Boehner aside, take his encyclical seriously, then you will have a significant part of the human population all over the world getting serious about this. This is one of these issues that, you know, I, as a philosopher of religion and theologian, this is central to me, that the religion of the world, the Christianity and the other religions of the world, should be leading the way here. Well, we really haven't been. And there are many reasons for this. In the United States, one of those reasons is that a significant percent, almost half of the American population, accepts a very conservative kind of theology which says that God can stop it. And some have even claimed, you know, it'd be arrogant for us to be saying that we could change the climate, because that's God's job. So that's one of the many factors. And so, you know, the Pope, although he's said many progressive things that have made many of us very happy, he is still, at least what he has to represent, is a very conservative theology. And so if the Catholics start taking climate change seriously, and that means starting to work against it, like divesting and so on, well, then maybe American evangelicals will too. There are a few evangelical Christians who tried to lead the way, to lead the evangelical church, but they got, you know, ganged up on, and for the most part, the evangelical community has remained not supportive and still even arguing that we don't have to worry about it because God's in charge. Well, if the Pope would get the equally conservative Catholics to make the switch and say, well, look, sure, God is powerful, but God has turned over the earth to us. And that's essentially what the Pope is saying, without saying that in so many words. Then maybe more evangelicals, like some evangelicals already say, hold that view.
David Ray Griffin, we're just about out of time here. The book that you've just released is called Unprecedented: Can Civilization Survive the CO2 Crisis? Richard Falk wrote about this. He said, if you can read only one book on climate change, make it unprecedented. With extraordinary clarity and comprehensiveness, David Griffin has masterfully depicted both the severe dangers confronting humanity and the best available escape routes. If reading this book does not change your life, nothing will. And David, I have to admit that having read this book this week, you've done an amazing job of laying out this issue quite clearly. We are in a major crisis facing us now. The methane alone could accelerate the warming dramatically, very quickly. So that, of course, is important. And then you talk about the need for a new abolition movement, the abolishing of fossil fuels and CO2 adding to the atmosphere, like immediately. Anything you would like to conclude with?
It's hard to say which of my chapters I think is the most important if people are going to read one. I think maybe the chapter on clean energy, because one of the many ways in which the mass media have not dealt with this issue, and by the way, I blame primarily the mass media for the problem we're in, particularly in the United States, more than the fossil fuel companies, because they're just doing what we expect them to do, just make as much money as they can and not care about anybody else. But the media, they're supposed to be serving the public and the work for the public good, and yet they don't give us much report. They give a lot of attention to denialists. They let people continue to believe that going green would be way too expensive. My electric bills will go up, and so on. Well, actually, the cost of solar electricity and wind-produced electricity is going down. In some places, it's already cheaper than energy from coal or any other fossil fuel. So what I tried to show in that chapter is that there is far more clean energy available in the world. The solar energy by itself could electrify the world many times over, and yet the media doesn't tell us that because they're still raking in the big bucks from the commercials from ExxonMobil and so on.
David Ray Griffin, thank you so very much for joining us today. That's a inspiring yet very terrifying report on where we stand with climate disruption today. Thank you very much.
Thank you, colleagues.
We've been speaking with David Ray Griffin, professor of philosophy and religion and theology, emeritus at Claremont School of Theology. Our next guest is Dar Jamail, a Truth Out staff reporter who has been writing articles on global environmental issues entitled The Brink of Mass Extinction, The Sixth Mass Extinction, begins in 2015, and how it's 2015 will be the hottest year on record. Jamail is author of The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan, Behind the Green Line, Dispatches from Unvetted Reporters in Iraq. He reported from Iraq for many years, also from Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, and Turkey. He has won the Martha Gellhorn Award for investigative reporting, among many others. Dar, welcome.
Thanks, Peter. Good to be with you.
For the past couple of years now, you've been writing for Truth Out, and you've really been addressing issues of global warming and what you call the brink of mass extinction. Tell us about your concerns, and you use the terminology anthropogenic climate disruption, ACD.
That's right. I decided to basically make this my primary beat as a journalist because, well, obviously it goes without saying, it's how could you possibly have a bigger story, a more important story that affects every single human being and every other living thing on the planet. And so I started working full-time for Truth Out, where I'd been freelancing off and on for almost a decade, but I came on with them full-time in February of last year, and around that time started what we call the monthly climate disruption dispatch. And what I do is every month I'm collating information from around the world that pertains to the most recent scientific data, reports, as well as blatantly obvious major climatic tide events, like, for example, the massive amount of wildfires happening right now, record-setting temperatures across the globe every single month, you know, all these things that are tied directly to climate disruption. So that's what I've been keeping myself busy with, and the dispatches have been very, very well received, and it seems like the more I do them, the more people want to read them, which is good. And then that kind of leads me to the term anthropogenic climate disruption. I knew writing about this topic in the U.S., where the denial movement is so strong and so well-funded, even though there's such a dramatic minority, I knew I needed to be very, very specific in my stories and make them bulletproof. So, you know, one of the methods the denial folks use is well, there's climate's changing all the time. Do you call it climate change? Why do you even do that? It's, and technically, factually, they are correct. Climate is changing every second, and always has been, and it always will. So if we just are more specific and call it what it is, which is anthropogenic, i.e. human-caused climate disruption, because what we've done by literally changing the composition of the atmosphere by emitting so much CO2 and then other things like methane into it, where we've literally changed the composition to the point where we're changing the human's ability to live on the planet. The title of my most recent dispatch that you just mentioned, I'm basically citing a new report that just came out fairly recently where, you know, we've known we're entering the sixth great mass extinction event. Elizabeth Colbert has a great book out on it, and there's been a lot of people and scientists pointing towards that, but now for the first time, we have a peer-reviewed scientific report published in Science Advance that came from several professors from several universities stating, yes, we have officially entered the sixth great mass extinction event, and in fact, it's happening so fast that we're already on a pace of species extinction that is far eclipsing that of the previous worst mass extinction event, which was the Permian mass extinction event, where over 90% of all life on the planet went extinct, and that happened about 250 million years ago. And current background extinction rates are 10 times faster, or they're happening 10 times faster than they were even during the Permian mass extinction.
So a number of people talk about the sixth mass extinction and, like, yeah, kind of have the attitude that's too bad about these other animals, but they seem to have no consideration that this is going to impact on humans. You talk about the near-term human extinction. What is the evidence for that?
Actually, the report that I just mentioned cites that. It talks about how humans are actually on, most likely we as a species are in the first wave, the first broad wave of species that will be made extinct. So that is addressed directly in the study. And also the study also says that they emphasize that their calculations are very likely an underestimate of the severity of the extinction crisis. So they're alarming enough in themselves, but then they throw in this caveat that actually these are the conservative end of the statements given the peer-reviewed scientific nature of the report. And so it's clear, and then I have been talking with many, many scientists. Some NASA folks, even off the record, have mentioned this, and, you know, and they look at it from a universal perspective, literally, where they're looking out at planets and what happens on a global scale all around the universe every day. And so to look at the U.S. from that perspective, considering, for example, Venus used to have oceans and a climate not too dissimilar from what we have now, yet something happened that triggered this massive shift to where their atmosphere got filled with an enormous amount of CO2 and is the extreme version of kind of where we're headed right now, to the point where all the oceans dried up and it's, you know, you could melt lead on the surface of the planet. It's so hot there. And so, you know, that kind of thing happens all the time around the universe. And so for people to think that, well, this is a planet, we're a species that haven't actually been here very long at all from a geological perspective, and yet people think somehow we're going to be immune to that, or that couldn't possibly happen to us. In reality, we're just another species on this planet, albeit one with the capability to literally change the composition of the atmosphere and render ourselves extinct. But it is happening. I mean, we have officially entered the sixth great mass extinction event, and when we kill off species that we depend on for food, when we are causing temperature changes across the planet at a rate that outpaces nature's ability to adapt, i.e. trees and agriculture, again impacting our abilities to feed ourselves, and then using up all the clean water for things like fracking and industrialization and pollution, then, you know, it doesn't take really a genius to connect the dots.
Dr. Ma, you've been writing about global extinction now for a couple years, and it's becoming very alarming. Certainly, we know about Pope Francis having meetings at the Vatican, inviting mayors from all over to pressure the UN. But we have some, you know, very serious denial going on as well. So how do we deal with this? I mean, do we need a abolition movement that demands the immediate stop burning of fossil fuels?
Well, Naomi Oreskes is an author who co-authored a book called Merchants of Doubt, and she, at that time, went through different instances of U.S. history where well-funded movements have effectively changed the argument. So, for example, the primary example she cited was the efforts by Big Tobacco to try to instill doubt that they were actually addictive. And she lines it out. These are the players. This is where the money came from. This is how it worked. These are the people that carried out the marching orders. And it's an extremely well-written, well-researched book. And she had a chapter on the climate denial movement. It traces it all the way back to an institute funded by Exxon, started back in the early 50s, and how that's morphed into the modern-day denial movement. My perspective as a journalist, I include a section in my dispatches called Denial and Reality because I always like to poke some fun at what the latest buffoonery to come out of the denial movement, some of the most recent idiotic quotes, and, you know, these people, you know, some of the whatever James Inhofe latest absurdity, you know, I like to get that down so folks can have a chuckle. But beyond that, I've decided to not spend time on it because despite the hundreds of millions of dollars that movement is pouring into trying to instill doubt, et cetera, it's ineffective in that still, despite their best efforts, all the polling shows that the clear majority of people in this country understand that there is climate change. They believe it. They get that it's happening. I think most people don't have a clue as to how severe, how far along we already are off of this path. But most people do understand and get and accept that it's happening. And so I think it's just really important to keep putting out the factual information. People are responding to it, at least our readership, and it does appear to be growing. And as hard as the information is to take in, people want the truth. As hard and as scary and as emotionally upsetting as it can be, as it should be, I think people want to know the truth because they want to understand what's happening in the world and also be able to have the information they need to make decisions in order to take care of themselves and the people that they care about. So I think that as far as what to do, I think that it needs to be on a community and a local level. I think anyone talking about changing the government or keeping all the fossil fuels in the ground, I mean, yeah, all that would be great, but let's look at how effective that's been. How effective was the anti-war movement at stopping Iraq? You know, how effective have any of the modern movements been at really doing anything? And this is the single largest problem happening. It is a human-caused problem, but it's on a global scale. And we've never been in this situation as a species. And I think any false solutions that are being put out there, like we can turn this around, we can sequester it, we can get it back in the ground, we can, you know, that's just not going to happen if we take a realistic, honest assessment of it. And so I think the important thing to do is ask ourselves, how can I build resiliency for myself and the people I care about and tie into the community around me and work within that community to do the same thing? And that's what I try to do where I live. And I know a lot of people trying to do that. And I think that, and consequently, that will, I think, be a very effective thing at reducing our own carbon emissions and trying to live more simply and closer to the ground, because ultimately that's going to be the best thing for the planet anyhow.
So in this whole discussion, could you give us some ideas of what are some of the key components that are going on, especially like the possibility of a huge methane burst, or maybe explain the self-reinforcing positive feedback loops? That's something that I think it's hard to get a grasp on.
That's right. I interviewed recently a fellow named Guy McPherson. He's a professor emeritus, University of Arizona, professor of evolutionary biology and ecology, and has been studying climate change now for over three decades. And he's talked a whole lot about what he calls near-term human extinction, and he really doesn't see any way out of it. Obviously, this is a debatable topic. Nobody can say for sure what's going to happen, but he's the person that has pointed out things like we have had abrupt climatological shifts on the planet before that have resulted in very, very fast devastating effects. I mean, he points out the fact that 55 million years ago, there was a 5°C temperature rise in global temperatures that occurred in only 13 years. And that was according to a 2013 study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. So we're talking about the top-tier scientific journals that we have on the planet where these reports are being published, i.e. they're irrefutable. There was another report that year also that was published in Science that said in the near term, the Earth's climate is projected to change 10 times faster than in any other moment in the last 65 million years. So we are looking at a lot of very, very clear signals that show that we are definitely in abrupt climate change at this point, and also pointing to the fact that we had scientific confirmation that the first 6 months of this year were the single hottest 6 months ever recorded on the planet's history. So literally every month we're just setting new records. We're on the famous Michael Mann hockey stick chart where we're basically going straight up at this point as far as how fast things are occurring. And then you brought up the self-reinforcing feedback loops. It's kind of the vicious circle where basically an example of this would be methane release that's already happening in the Arctic, where we have massive amounts of methane that are currently frozen into the permafrost and frozen under the shallow seas of the Arctic Ocean. The ice up there, as everyone knows, is melting extremely rapidly. And as the permafrost melts, the methane, which is a greenhouse gas that's 100 times more potent than CO2 on a 20-year time scale, that's being released into the atmosphere, which warms it further, which in turn causes more of the ice to melt, which in turn causes more of the methane to release. So that's one example, and I think the most dramatic example of a positive feedback loop. Guy McPherson, Dr. McPherson, says he's now tracking over 50 positive feedback loops that have been kicked in, and adding a minimum of one every 2 weeks at this point.
We're speaking with Dar Jamal, a Truth Out staff reporter, on his latest article, The Sixth Mass Extinction Event Begins 2015 on the pace to become the hottest year on record. I'm Peter Phillips. My co-host today is Julie Onjewski. She's a professor emeritus of human relations and multicultural education at St. Cloud University. Dar, this is dire. You write about the depletion of the world aquifers. You talk about the massive increase in warming just this year and the possibility of accelerated warming in the near future. What troubles you the most?
That's a good question. It's really all of it. What troubles me the most is really, at this point, less of what I'm watching as far as all the runaway feedback loops and how more out of control things are getting on the planet as a result of climate disruption. But really what troubles me most is just how most people and governments are just going about business as usual, as though this is something, a can we can kick down the road like we have so many other problems, and not having a dramatic, immediate reaction to this, where we are literally in a survival situation, and yet people are behaving as though, well, we can do it next year, or maybe when the next president comes, or, you know, yeah, we can go ahead and just keep having children and consuming and acting like nothing's going to happen. And reality is, we're on a planet that things are happening so fast. You know, another study I cited in one of my recent dispatches that a child born today will see a Mount Everest that will have no glaciers on it by 2100. A child born today is going to see a near total collapse of the ocean systems of the planet and their ability to support food at a level that we can even eat. A child born today is going to see over 50% of all the forests on the planet not be in existence by the time they grow old. I mean, this is how fast things are happening, and it's extremely difficult information to take in, and that's another reason why I always cite only peer-reviewed scientific reports of the highest caliber. So things like NASA, things like peer-reviewed studies published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, Science Magazine, Nature Climate Change, Nature, all the highest caliber things, because I think, you know, one of the things people do is kind of go into denial and survive, like emotional survival mechanisms, when they hear this information. And that's understandable. I think we all do that. You know, I mean, even I sometimes will, like, hey, I just need to tune out from this for a while. I've been reading it all day. Go watch a movie or something. But I think we have to come back to it. I think we have to pay attention in order to really be in this moment, you know. And I know a lot of people are now referring to this as, you know, some of their feelings come up as kind of environmental melancholia. I just wrote an article about that where a lot of our readers shared what they're seeing and some of their feelings around the dramatic changes they're seeing around where they live. And then and then interviewed an artist who shared a lot of her work that addresses directly this, that, you know, what we're seeing are, you know, when we hear about something like a species going extinct, well, that's another small death, and we have to treat it accordingly, and we have to mourn it and deal with that internally, because the big death, which is that of what's happening globally and what's happening, that the fact that our own species is possibly facing near-term extinction. I'm not saying that's happening for sure, but it's a very distinct possibility. And what the artist called, Regan Rosenberg is her name, and what she called the big death. And that, you know, those are so hard for us to take in, that we are in a position now where it's the small deaths. We need to start dealing with those and reacting accordingly. And I think it's against the backdrop of a capitalist system and a consumer culture that wants you to do the opposite. It's like, forget about it. It's going to be okay. What's the next Apple product coming out? What do you want on your pizza? I mean, that's basically the world that they want us to live in. So we just keep buying things and consuming and going into further debt and feeding the beast that's destroying the planet. And so, you know, excuse me for kind of waxing philosophical here, but it's a whole lot to take in. I mean, to have this information, I think we simultaneously need to read it, but then we simultaneously, as readers, and then even me as a journalist, need to talk about, well, okay, now what do we do about it? And I think that the only answer to that lies on a very, very personal level of what each person's going to need to do to incorporate the information and then make decisions about, okay, now how am I going to live my life in this situation, understanding the dramatic changes that are happening across the planet.
Your most recent article, you talk about how the industrial economic system may collapse as part of this whole problem. Could you describe that?
Well, that's right, and that's why we have even the IMF and the World Bank issuing very alarming reports about, hey, we're projecting 4C increase by 2050, and then they keep moving the years up, increasing in the speed at which it's warming. And they talk about the obvious, immediate, deleterious economic impacts. So it's not going to be good for Miami's economy when, you know, we just had the James Hansen and other scientists collaborated on this big report, effectively being ignored. But, you know, prior to their report on sea level rise, the worst case IPCC projection showed a 2-meter sea level rise by 2100. Their report is talking about 10 feet, which is basically 3-meter sea level rise by 2050. That because of the pace at which the Antarctic and Greenland are melting is so much faster than anyone thought before, and they did the models and they've run the studies and all the scientific data is there for everyone to check out, and it's all online. That means we don't have Miami by 2050. That's not going to be good for Miami's economy. That's not going to be good for the national economy. What do you do with all those climate refugees? What happens to all those jobs? That's one city. Now factor that in around the entire coast of the United States. Now factor that in around to the entire coast of the entire planet, given the vast majority of the people on the planet live within 20 miles of a coast. That's just one example, not even to talk about what happens to your state. Okay, say we have a big El Nino and you guys have a bunch of rain and you get a bit of a respite from this mega drought that you're in. But again, looking at it from a geological perspective, that's just a hiccup in time. The drought's going to persist. It's going to become the new norm there. The El Nino will pass. You'll have another several years in a row of staggering drought. What happens when California loses its ability to support the agriculture industry that's so huge there? And then, you know, I guess the one thought I would leave people, you know, when you hear this argument, well, we have to make compromises between the economy and what we really need to do to try to mitigate climate disruption. You know, a quote that Dr. McPherson shared with me a ways back that I think kind of summed it up is he said, well, if you think the economy is more important than the environment, try holding your breath while you count your money.
Dr. Mill, thank you very much. We're out of time today. You've been writing at Truth Out. This is where people could find your articles. Are there other good sources you recommend?
There's several good blogs. There's robertscribbler.com, keeps a very, very good environmental blog. And then aside from that, just, you know, the basic reports that NASA and NOAA are consistently putting out, very important data. So there's a lot of great information out there, and I certainly encourage folks to stay tuned into it.
Well, Dar, thank you very much.
Thank you guys for having me on. Appreciate it.
And Julie Andrzejewski, thank you also for being co-host today. Greatly appreciated it.
It was great. Thank you very much.
Project Censored is a proud co-host of the National Whistleblower Summit on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C., July 29th to 31st. The events celebrate the collective achievements of whistleblowers and their advocates. Meet and hear from whistleblowers in the public and private sector who have stood up to the public good and suffered severe retaliation. Among this year's Peller Award winners in journalism are Abby Martin of Media Roots, Dennis Bernstein from KPFA, and Tom Englehart.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, 'cause they own by special.
You're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM and on the web at kbu.fm. At 10:15, stay tuned for Flashpoints. We'll hear more on Portland protests on land and sea to block Shell Oil's icebreaking ship from heading out to the Arctic. Also, we remember the life and times of radical environmentalist and Earth Firster Judy Berry. At 11 o'clock, Kristen Yount hosts a program about the Willamette River Revival. It's a celebration of the future health of the Willamette River with guests Barbara Quinn of the Portland Harbor Community Advisory Board, Feduma Ali of Groundworks, and Roger Wendlick, award-winning Lewis and Clark historian and author of Shotgun on My Chest. But right now we're going to get to to Air Ascadia headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Wednesday, July 29th, 2015, and you are listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. Coming up, 15 minutes.